Donnie General, to explain what a disaster this would be, certainly in terms of the relationship with the United States. And Begg agreed to abandon the Iranian talks. But it seemed now that in their relations with the Pakistan Army, American officials were racing from one fire to the next. A popular rebellion had erupted late in 1989 across Pakistan's border in the disputed territory of Kashmir, a vale of mountain lakes with a largely Muslim population that had been the site of three wars in four decades between India and Pakistan. Inspired by their success against Soviet forces in Afghanistan, Pakistani intelligence officers announced to Bhutto that they were prepared to use the same methods of covert jihad to drive India out of Kashmir. They had begun to build up Muslim Brotherhood militant networks in the Kashmir Valley, using religious schools and professional organizations. ISI organized training camps for Kashmiri guerrillas in Afghanistan's Paktia province, where the Arab volunteers had earlier organized their own camps. According to the CIA's reporting that year, the Kashmiri volunteers trained side by side with the Arab jihadists. The Kashmir guerrillas began to surface in Indian-held territory, wielding Chinese-made Kalashnikov rifles and other weapons siphoned from the Afghan pipeline. The CIA became worried that Pakistani intelligence might also divert to Kashmir high-technology weapons such as the Buffalo Gun sniper rifles originally shipped to Pakistan to kill Soviet military officers. The United States passed private warnings to India to protect politicians and government officials traveling in Kashmir from long-range sniper attacks. The Afghan jihad had crossed one more border. It was about to expand again. By late 1990, bin Laden had returned to his family's business in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. He remained in cordial contact with Ahmed Badib, the chief of staff to Saudi intelligence, who offered bin Laden business advice when he asked for it. Badib learned that bin Laden had begun to organize former Saudi and Yemeni volunteers from his days in Afghanistan to undertake a new jihad in South Yemen, then governed by Soviet-backed Marxists. Working from apartment buildings in Jeddah, he had funded and equipped them to open a guerrilla war against the South Yemen government. Once bin Laden's mujahideen crossed the border, the Yemeni government picked up some of them and complained to Riyadh, denouncing bin Laden by name. By the autumn of 1990, bin Laden was agitated, too, about the threat facing Saudi Arabia from the Iraqi army forces that had invaded and occupied Kuwait in August. Bin Laden wanted to lead a new jihad against the Iraqis. He spoke out at schools and small gatherings in Jeddah about how it would be possible to defeat Saddam Hussein by organizing battalions of righteous Islamic volunteers. Bin Laden objected violently to the decision of the Saudi royal family to invite American troops to defend the kingdom. He demanded an audience with senior princes in the Saudi royal family, and King Fahd himself, to present his plans for a new jihad. Uncertain what to make of bin Laden's rantings, and concerned about the violence he was stirring up in Yemen, a senior Saudi prince, along with a pro-government Islamic theologian named Khalil A. Khalil, traveled to Jeddah to hear bin Laden out and assess his state of mind. Bin Laden brought bodyguards to the private meeting. He carried a proposal of about 60 pages, typed in Arabic, outlining his ideas. Khalil found bin Laden very formal, very tense. Bin Laden demanded to meet with King Fahd. He declared, "I want to fight against Saddam, an infidel. I want to establish a guerrilla war against Iraq." Khalil asked how many troops bin Laden had. 60,000, bin Laden boasted, and 20,000 Saudis. Khalil and the prince knew this was foolishness, but bin Laden boasted, "I don't need any weapons. I have plenty." Finally, the senior prince at the meeting told bin Laden that the Saudi king would not meet with him. The king only met with ulama, religious scholars, he said. But since bin Laden was making a military proposal, and since he was a respected scion of an important Saudi family, the prince agreed to arrange a meeting between bin Laden and Prince Sultan, Saudi Arabia's defense minister. "I am the commander of an Islamic army. I am not afraid of being put in jail or being in prison. I am only afraid of Allah," bin Laden announced as the meeting ended, as Khalil recalled it. The senior prince told bin Laden that what he had just said is against the law and against principles. But it is not our custom to arrest someone whom you have agreed to meet in good faith. My advice is to examine yourself very carefully. We are not afraid of you. We are not afraid of your army. We know what to do. You listen to America, your master, bin Laden answered. In Riyadh, bin Laden arrived at the defense ministry with military maps and diagrams. Abdullah al-Turki, Secretary General of the Muslim World League, the largest worldwide Saudi proselytizing organization, joined the meeting. He was there to explain to bin Laden that the American troops invited to the kingdom had religious sanction. Mohammed had intended for no religion but Islam to dominate the Saudi peninsula, al-Turki said. But the Prophet had never objected to Jews and Christians traveling in the region or helping to defend it. The Saudi kingdom could avoid using an army of American infidels to fight its war, bin Laden argued, if it would support his army of battle-tested Afghan war veterans. Prince Sultan treated bin Laden with warmth and respect, but said that he doubted that bin Laden's plan would work. The Iraqi army had 4,000 tanks.
There are no caves in Kuwait, Prince Sultan said. You cannot fight them from the mountains and caves.
What will you do when he lobs the missiles at you with chemical and biological weapons?
We will fight him with faith, bin Laden said.
The meeting ended inconclusively, with respectful salutations. Even if his ideas seemed crazy, bin Laden belonged to one of the kingdom's most important families. He had worked closely with the Saudi government. In situations like this, Saudi mores encouraged the avoidance of direct conflict. Prince Turki saw bin Laden's meeting at the defense ministry as a watershed. From that time on, the Saudi intelligence chief saw radical changes in bin Laden's personality.
He changed from a calm, peaceful, and gentle man, interested in helping Muslims, into a person who believed that he would be able to amass and command an army to liberate Kuwait. It revealed his arrogance and his haughtiness.
It was not only bin Laden who shocked Prince Turki that autumn by rejecting the kingdom's alliance with the United States against Iraq. So did Hekmatyar and Sayaf, despite all the millions of dollars in aid they had accepted from Saudi intelligence. As the prime minister of the Afghan interim government, Sayaf delivered public speeches in Peshawar denouncing the Saudi royal family as anti-Islamic. The Bush administration dispatched diplomats to urge Pakistan and the Saudi royal family to rein in their Afghan clients. Whereas before, their anti-Americanism did not have more than slight impact beyond the Afghan context, during the current crisis, they fan anti-US and anti-Saudi sentiment in Pakistan and Afghanistan, as well as beyond, noted a State Department action memorandum. Furious, Turki sent Ahmed Badib to Pakistan. By the time he arrived in Peshawar, Badib could barely contain his rage.
When I am upset, I lose my mind, Badib explained later.
He barged into a public meeting where Sayaf was denouncing Saudi Arabia for its bargain with the American devils.
Now you are coming to tell us what to do in our religion? Badib demanded. Even your own name, I changed it to become a Muslim name.
If the Afghan interim government wanted to send a delegation of mujahideen to help defend Saudi Arabia against the Iraqis, that might be a way to help people recognize that there is something in the world called an Afghan Islamic Republic. But if Sayaf refused,
I am going to make you really regret what you have said.
In case he had not made himself clear, the chief of staff of Saudi intelligence told Sayaf directly,
"Fuck you and your family and the Afghans,"
and he stormed out. The threads of the Cold War's jihad alliance were coming apart. 12. We are in danger. By early 1991, the Afghan policies pursued by the State Department and the CIA were in open competition with one another. Both departments sought a change of government in Kabul, but they had different Afghan clients. Peter Thompson and his supporters in State's Bureau of Intelligence and Research pursued what they saw as a bottom-up or grassroots strategy. They channeled guns and money to the new rebel commander's Shura, which attracted members from across Afghanistan, and they emphasized the importance of Massoud. They also continued to negotiate for a broad political settlement that would include popular national figures such as the exiled king. The CIA sometimes cooperated with these efforts, however grudgingly, but it also continued to collaborate with Pakistani intelligence on a separate military track that mainly promoted Hekmatyar and other Islamist commanders operating near the Pakistani border. That winter, the ISI and the CIA returned to the strategy that had been tried unsuccessfully in the two previous years, a massed attack on an eastern Afghan city with direct participation by covert Pakistani forces. In the previous campaign, the CIA had tried to support such an attack by paying Massoud to close the Salang Highway, and the agency had been greatly disappointed. This time, officers in the Directorate of Operations Near East Division came up with a new idea. Early in March 1991, overwhelmed and in retreat, Saddam Hussein's army abandoned scores of Soviet-made tanks and artillery pieces in Kuwait and southern Iraq. The discarded weaponry offered the potential for a classical covert action play. The CIA would secretly use spoils captured from one of America's enemies to attack another enemy. The CIA station in Riyadh, working with Saudi intelligence, assigned a team of covert logistics officers to round up abandoned T-55 and T-72 Iraqi tanks, armored personnel carriers, and artillery pieces. The CIA team worked with the U.S. military in southern Iraq to loot abandoned Iraqi armories and ammunition stores. They refurbished the captured equipment and rolled it to Kuwaiti ports for shipment to Karachi. From there, Pakistani intelligence brought the armor and artillery to the Afghan border. Officers from ISI's Afghan Bureau used the equipment to support massive new conventional attacks on the eastern city of Gardez in Paktia province, the ISI-supplied stronghold of Jalaluddin Haqqani, Hekmatyar, and the Arab volunteers. Officers in the CIA's Near East Division had come to believe that the Afghan rebels needed more conventional assault equipment to match the firepower of Najibullah's Afghan army. There had been earlier talk of shipping in U.S.-made 155mm howitzers, but now the Iraqi gambit seemed a better idea. It was cheaper, and the equipment could not be traced directly to Washington. Soviet-made Iraqi armor was of the same type that the Mujahideen sometimes captured from Afghan government troops. So if a rebel force suddenly emerged on the outskirts of Khost or Gardez with a new tank brigade, it would not be obvious where their armor came from. Peter Thompson and others at the State Department agreed to support the secret transfers of Iraqi weapons. They worried about declining morale among the rebels after months of military stalemate and thought the new equipment might provide a much-needed jolt. At the same time, they did not want the Iraqi tanks and artillery to strengthen the discredited anti-American Islamists around Hekmatyar. After Hekmatyar and Sayyaf failed to support Saudi Arabia publicly in its confrontation with Iraq, both the United States and Saudi intelligence initially vowed to cut them off. Saudi Arabia's ambassador to Pakistan, meeting at ISI headquarters with American diplomats and the chief of Pakistani intelligence, announced that all Saudi funding to Hekmatyar and Sayyaf should stop. But within months, it became clear to the Americans that the Saudis were still secretly allowing cash and weapons to reach Hekmatyar and Sayyaf. The CIA's Afghan budget continued to shrink. Total funding allocated by Congress for the Mujahideen fell again during calendar year 1991. What little aid there was should be used to build up the rebel leaders who opposed Hekmatyar, the State Department's diplomats argued. But the CIA maintained that it had never been able to control how Pakistani intelligence distributed the weapons it received. The agreement had always been that title passed to ISI once the equipment reached Pakistani soil. Thompson and others at State complained that the CIA surely was capable of controlling the destination of its weapons, but Langley's officers said they could not. Besides, CIA officers argued, Hekmatyar's coup attempt with Tanai demonstrated his tactical daring. Most of the rebel commanders were just sitting on their haunches waiting for the war to end. Saudi intelligence endorsed the Iraqi tank gambit and fully supported the covert plan, the CIA reported. They would try to keep the tanks away from Hekmatyar and encourage Pakistani intelligence to send them to the rebel commander Jalaluddin Haqqani. After false starts in the two previous fighting seasons, here was a chance at last to help tip the military balance in Afghanistan against Najibullah, the agency's operatives argued. With ISI officers helping to direct the attack from nearby hilltops, a coalition of Mujahideen forces lay siege to Khost as spring arrived. Its main garrison fell in late March 1991, the most significant rebel victory since the withdrawal of Soviet troops. But Peter Thompson's hope that the victory would boost the power of his commander's shura was thwarted. Pakistani intelligence ensured that Hekmatyar reached the city with the first conquerors. He promptly claimed the victory as his own in public speeches. ISI Chief Durrani drove across the Afghan border and made a triumphal tour of Khost, as did the Pakistani leader of Jamaat-e-Islami, Qazi Hussain Ahmed. Their appearances made plain the direct role of the Pakistani military and Muslim Brotherhood networks in the assault. The rising presence of radical Arab, Indonesian, Malaysian, Uzbek, and other volunteer fighters in Paktia was documented in the agency's own reporting from the field. CIA cables from Pakistan during this period, drawing on reports from Afghan agents, provided Langley with detailed accounts of the jihadist training camps in Paktia. The CIA reported, for instance, that Saudi radical volunteers were training side by side with Kashmiri radicals, and that the Kashmiris were being prepared by Pakistani intelligence for infiltration into Indian-held territory. The CIA also reported that substantial numbers of Algerian and other North African Islamist radicals were training in Paktia, some fighting with Hekmatyar's Afghan forces and others with Sayaf. All this detailed intelligence reporting about international Islamic radicalism and its sanctuary in Afghanistan gathered dust in the middle levels of the bureaucracy. The Gulf War, the reunification of Germany, the final death throes of the Soviet Union. These enormous, all-consuming crises continued to command the attention of the Bush administration's cabinet. By 1991, Afghanistan was rarely, if ever, on the agenda. Milt Bearden, the former Islamabad station chief, found himself talking in passing about the Afghan war with President Bush. The president seemed puzzled that the CIA's covert pipeline through Pakistan was still active, as Bearden recalled it. Bush seemed surprised, too, that the Afghans were still fighting. "Is that thing still going on?" the president asked. Saudi Arabia's royal family spent generously to appease the kingdom's Islamist radicals in the years following the uprising at the Grand Mosque in 1979. Billions of dollars poured into the coffers of the kingdom's official ulama, who issued their fatwas increasingly from air-conditioned, oak-furnished offices. Billions more supported mosque-building campaigns in provincial towns and oasis villages. Thousands of idle young Saudi men were recruited into the domestic religious police and dispatched to the kingdom's gleaming new sandstone and glass shopping malls. There they harassed women who allowed high-heeled shoes to show beneath their black robes and used wooden batons to round up Saudi men for daily prayers. New Islamic universities rose in Riyadh and Jeddah, and thousands of students were enrolled to study the Quran. At the same time, the royal family stoked its massive modernization drive, constructing intercity highways, vast new housing, industrial plants, and hospitals. Saudi women entered the workforce in record numbers, although they often worked in strict segregation from men. Secular princes and princesses summered in London, Cannes, Costa del Sol, and Switzerland. There were at least 6,000 self-described princes in the Saudi royal family by 1990, and their numbers grew by the year. Many of these royals paid little heed to the Islamic clergy who governed official Saudi culture. Osama bin Laden returned to Saudi Arabia from Pakistan just as new fissures opened between its austere, proselytizing religious establishment and its diverse, undisciplined royal family. For many Saudis, the Iraqi invasion and the arrival of hundreds of thousands of American troops to defend the kingdom shattered the myth of Saudi independence and ignited open debate about Saudi identity. To both Islamists and modernizers, the war seemed a turning point. Saudi women staged protests against the kingdom's ban on female drivers, defiantly taking the wheel on the streets of Riyadh and Dhahran. Liberal political activists petitioned for a representative assembly that might advise the royal family. Islamists denounced the arrival of Christian troops as a violation of Islamic law. Two fiery young preachers known as the Awakening Sheikhs recorded anti-American sermons on cassette tapes and circulated millions of copies around the kingdom in late 1990 and early 1991. "It is not the world against Iraq. It is the West against Islam," declared Sheikh Safar al-Hawali, a bin Laden ally. "If Iraq has occupied Kuwait, then America has occupied Saudi Arabia. The real enemy is not Iraq. It is the West." Al-Hawali's best-known book, Kissinger's Promise, argued that American-led crusaders intended to conquer the Arabian Peninsula to seize its oil reserves. He warned Saudi citizens, "It will not be long until your blood is shed with impunity, or you declare your abandonment of your belief in God." These were themes bin Laden himself propounded in informal lectures at Jeddah mosques. He adopted al-Hawali's politics and some of the preacher's terminology. He found himself part of a widening movement in the kingdom. Other anti-royal agitators saw his participation as an indication of how serious the rebellion had become, recalled Saudi journalist and author Saudi Aburish, because bin Laden was a member of the establishment who had suddenly announced himself as a radical Islamist against the regime. In May 1991, an underground Saudi network of Islamist preachers and activists obtained scores of signatures on a petition called the Letter of Demands that was submitted to King Fahd. The petition blended calls for quasi-democratic political reform with radical Islamist ideology. It sought the unquestioned primacy of Islamic law, equal distribution of public wealth, more funding for Islamic institutions, religious control of the media, and a consultative assembly independent of the royal family. The letter's publication shocked the Saudi royal family, in part because it revealed an extensive organization in the kingdom rallying in secret around a subversive agenda. Cassette tapes circulated that summer by the underground Islamist preachers grew in number and vitriol. A popular tape titled America as I Saw It informed its listeners that the United States was a nation of beasts who fornicate and eat rotten food, a land where men marry men and parents are abandoned as they age. Pushed to its limit, the Saudi royal family retaliated, making scores of arrests, but the government managed its repression gently. Senior princes did not want their crackdown to be seen as violent or arbitrary, or to create new waves of dissidents stoking unrest. The awakening sheikhs were placed under house arrest, but the government quickly opened negotiations to address some of their demands. Senior princes quietly sent messages to the official ulama acknowledging that, yes, the presence of American troops in the kingdom was undesirable, and their numbers and visibility would be reduced as soon as possible. Saudi princes stepped out in public to emphasize their devotion to Islamic causes, especially in places outside of Saudi Arabia, such as Afghanistan and Bosnia. The kingdom's Ministry of Pilgrimage and Religious Trusts announced that the government had spent about $850 million on mosque construction in recent years, employed 53,000 religious leaders in mosques, and planned to hire another 7,300 prayer leaders. King Fahd announced his intention to ship millions of free Qurans to the newly independent, predominantly Muslim countries of Central Asia. The proper and legal outlet for Islamic activism, the royal family made clear, lay not inside the kingdom, but abroad, in aid of the global Ummah, or community of Muslim believers. The rise of the awakening sheikhs and the emergence of the Letter of Demands prompted CIA officers and State Department diplomats to open talks with the Saudi royal family about the dangers of Islamic radicalism. American analysts were determined to intervene early with the Saudi royals to encourage the Saudis to be alert and responsive to signs of serious internal dissent. For the first time, the CIA began to see evidence that Arab jihadists trained in Afghanistan posed a threat in Saudi Arabia itself. Gary Schroen, now in the CIA's Riyadh station, discussed with Prince Turki the problem of Saudi radicals moving in and out of Afghanistan. "There are a lot of Saudi citizens there who are fighting," Schroen said, as he recalled it. "They're being trained. They're young men who are really dedicated, really religious, and a lot of them are coming back. They're here."
"We understand that," Turki assured him. "We are watching that. There is no problem. We'll take care of it."
The Saudi royal family had begun to worry. In Islamabad, the Saudi ambassador to Pakistan sat down with American officials to warn them about Islamist charity organizations on the Afghan frontier that were raising funds in the United States, then spending the money on radical and violent causes in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and beyond. "You should know about this," the Saudi envoy warned. The U.S. consulate in Peshawar composed a classified cable for Washington based on the Saudi envoy's information. The cable listed charity organizations in California and Texas that were sending cash and fighters to the Islamist network swirling around Hekmatyar and Sayaf. The cable was routed to the FBI and CIA, but the State Department officers who helped compile it never heard of any follow-up investigation. Peter Thompson and other emissaries from Washington discussed the rising Islamist threat with Prince Turki in the summer of 1991. Turki listened to their concerns, made few commitments, but repeated that he was on top of the problem. As so often, Turki, the most accessible contact for American spies and diplomats on the subject of political Islam, seemed reassuring. Turki was one of the liberals under assault from the underground Islamists. His sister had taken part in some of the attempts by women in Riyadh to win greater rights and visibility. She had been singled out and denounced as a prostitute by a preacher during Friday services at a Riyadh mosque. The next Friday, Turki attended the mosque, rose from the audience, and asked to speak. He denounced the slander against the women of his family, making clear that the attacks against liberals had gone too far. Impressed by his willingness to take a public stand, the Americans who met him were quick to believe that Turki was on their side and that he had the Islamist threat under control. At some of the meetings between Turki and the CIA, Osama bin Laden's name came up explicitly. The CIA continued to pick up reporting that he was funding radicals such as Hekmatyar in Afghanistan. Hekmatyar, Sayaf, and Haqqani all had officers around Saudi Arabia who collected money from mosques and wealthy sheikhs. Bin Laden was one part of this wider fundraising system.
"His family has disowned him," Turki assured the Americans about bin Laden.
Every effort had been made to persuade bin Laden to stop protesting against the Saudi royal family. These efforts had failed, Turki conceded, and the kingdom was now prepared to take sterner measures. Bin Laden learned of this when Saudi police arrived at his cushion-strewn, modestly furnished compound in Jeddah to announce that he would have to leave the kingdom. According to an account later provided to the CIA by a source in Saudi intelligence, the Saudi officer assigned to carry out the expulsion assured bin Laden that this was being done for his own good. The officer blamed the Americans. The U.S. government was planning to kill him, he told bin Laden, by this account, so the royal family would do him a favor and get him out of the kingdom for his own protection. Two associates of bin Laden later offered a different version while under interrogation. They said a dissident member of the royal family helped him leave the country by arranging for bin Laden to attend an Islamic conference in Pakistan during the spring of 1991. So far as is known, bin Laden never returned to the kingdom. Vodka-soaked Soviet hardliners, including leaders at the KGB, tried and failed to overthrow Mikhail Gorbachev on August 19, 1991. Within weeks, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, nemesis of the United States for almost half a century, collapsed as an effective political organization. Russian liberals, Russian nationalists, Baltic nationalists, Ukrainians, Kazakhs, and Uzbeks now ruled what remained of the Soviet Union, a nation constructed from Stalin's terror, hurtled toward its final dissolution. Gorbachev's weakening cabinet,
in search of rapid compromises with Washington, decided to abandon its aid to Najibullah in Afghanistan. In turn, the Bush cabinet felt free at last to drop all support to the Mujahideen. On September 13, U.S. Secretary of State James Baker and Soviet Foreign Minister Boris Pankin pledged a mutual cutoff of arms to Najibullah and the Afghan rebels as of January 1, 1992. 12 years after the Politburo decided to commit military force to defend communism in Afghanistan, 12 years and 2 months after Zbigniew Brzezinski had presented Jimmy Carter with a draft presidential finding for CIA covert action to support anti-communist rebels, both superpowers agreed to stop fueling the Afghan war. Yet the war continued. The brigadiers and colonels in Pakistani intelligence had never trusted that the CIA would see the Afghan jihad through to the end. Some of them had never really trusted the Americans, period. Bitterly, Pakistan's military officers congratulated themselves on how right they had been. In Kabul, Najibullah remained in power. The former Afghan king, Zahir Shah, remained at his villa in Rome. United Nations diplomats shuttled in their blue-stenciled airplanes between Kabul and Islamabad by the week, but the prospects for a peaceful political settlement appeared dim. Hekmatyar and other Islamists backed by Pakistani intelligence were creeping toward Kabul in their captured Iraqi tanks. Ahmed Shah Massoud had assembled a rival invasion force, including captured Soviet tanks, to Kabul's north, poised for a decisive drive on the capital. An extremist seizure of Kabul would plunge Afghanistan into a fresh round of warfare, which could affect areas adjoining Afghanistan, Peter Thompson warned in a secret cable to Washington that September 1991. Should Hekmatyar or Sayaf get to Kabul, extremists in the Arab world would support them in stoking Islamic radicalism in the region, including the Soviet Central Asian republics, but also in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere in the Arab world. In December, Thompson repeated his warnings in another cable, classified secret, and distributed throughout the national security bureaucracy in Washington. He feared a scramble for power that would further attenuate central authority in favor of local warlords. A political settlement must be put in place as rapidly as possible to forestall scenarios of continued instability and civil war in Afghanistan. But few at Foggy Bottom or Langley were focused on the future of Islamic politics or stability in Central Asia. In Afghanistan, the stage was set not for a triumphal reconciliation on one of the Cold War's most destructive battlefields, but for an ugly new phase of regional and civil war. The CIA's analysts and operatives had long argued that after the withdrawal of Soviet forces, the Afghans would have to try to sort things out for themselves. They would have little choice now but to try. The CIA's legal authority to conduct covert action in Afghanistan effectively ended on January 1, 1992. By then, the Soviet Union had formally dissolved. Peter Thompson suggested a new finding that would allow unilateral CIA clients to be used to bolster the UN negotiations seeking a moderate coalition government in Afghanistan. But the CIA and other diplomats in the State Department opposed the idea. The Islamabad station retained some of its Afghan agents 4 months into the new year, but these were now classified only as reporting relationships, traditional spying. Some of the CIA's Afghan commanders were converted to work on the secret Stinger buyback program, begun after the Soviet troop withdrawal, and now the only covert action program authorized in Afghanistan. Others were directed to report on new post-Cold War priorities, such as drug trafficking. From fertile Helmand in the south to the gorge valleys of the northeast, Afghanistan flowered each spring with one of the world's largest crops of opium poppies. Untroubled by government, and funded by smugglers and organized crime networks rooted in Pakistan, Afghan poppy farmers supplied heroin labs nestled in cities and along the lawless Afghanistan-Pakistan border. By 1992, hundreds of tons of refined heroin flowed from these labs east through Karachi's port or north through the new overland routes of the Russian mafia, destined for European cities. By the early 1990s, Afghanistan rivaled Colombia and Burma as a fountainhead of global heroin supply. The CIA opened a new counter-narcotics center, modeled on the counter-terrorist center, and President Bush allocated secret funds for espionage in Afghanistan aimed at combating the heroin rackets. Even so, within 6 months of the January 1 formal cutoff, the CIA's Afghan operation had atrophied to a shadow of its former strength. The Islamabad station's liaison with ISI deteriorated by the week. The CIA had little to offer anymore. At one point, the agency found itself in the awkward, even perverse position of attempting to apply the legal rules of the Pressler Amendment to the secret shipments of captured Iraqi tanks and artillery that had reached Pakistan, bound for the Afghan rebels. Pressler required an end to all military equipment aid and sales by the United States to Pakistan. The CIA's lawyers concluded that the law might apply even to covert supplies such as the Iraqi tanks, especially if the armor had not yet crossed the Afghan border, as was the case with dozens of the tanks. The CIA station in Islamabad informed ISI that it would have to destroy any stored armor and artillery. The agency wanted the weapons taken to an army test range and blown up, with CIA officers present to confirm the destruction. "Surely you are joking," Pakistani intelligence officers told their CIA counterparts. Locked in an existential struggle with India, Pakistan was not about to blow up perfectly good tanks or artillery just because some lawyer in Langley was worried about a congressional subpoena. In the end, the CIA gave up. Pakistan held on to as many as 3 or 4 dozen Iraqi tanks, by one CIA estimate, despite the Pressler restrictions. Edmund McWilliams had been assigned to the inaugural U.S. Embassy in Dushanbe, Tajikistan, a newly independent, predominantly Muslim former Soviet republic bordering Afghanistan. In February 1992, travelers reaching the Tajik capital told McWilliams that one of Najibullah's most important allies in northern Afghanistan, a communist Uzbek militia commander named Abu-Rashid Dostum, had defected to Massoud's Supreme Council of the North. The word was out all across northern Afghanistan, the travelers said. Najibullah's days were at last numbered. The sudden alliance of Massoud's Tajik army with Dostum's Uzbek militia, 40,000 strong, in control of tanks, artillery, and even aircraft, tilted the military balance against Najibullah, just as his supplies from Moscow had been cut off. McWilliams cabled Washington, "The fall of Kabul, so long predicted and so long delayed, appeared now to be finally at hand." "We have a common task, Afghanistan, the USA, and the civilized world, to launch a joint struggle against fundamentalism," Najibullah told reporters in his palace office as the Mujahideen closed to within rocketing distance. "If fundamentalism comes to Afghanistan, war will continue for many years. Afghanistan will turn into a center of world smuggling for narcotic drugs. Afghanistan will be turned into a center for terrorism." Najibullah could see the future, but there was no one to listen. He had lost his Soviet patrons, and he was discredited, desperate. A United Nations mediator, Benem Savan, spent long hours with Najibullah that month, urging him to resign and throw his support to a peaceful transitional government that might isolate violent Islamic radicals like Hekmatyar. Najibullah agreed and read a speech on national television written for him by Savan, saying that he would quit the presidency as soon as a successor government was formed under UN auspices. The United States stood to the side. Oakley had left Islamabad. The embassy's chargé d'affaires, Beth Jones, preferred to defer to Pakistan. Thompson could not do much to influence America's outlook because Washington had just announced a new policy. Hands off. Just south of Kabul, in a wide valley tucked beneath soaring peaks, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar slipped his forces into the village called Charasyab and set up military operations. There were barracks, a radio room, training areas, and a mosque set in a pine grove. Pakistani helicopters flew in and out carrying ISI officers for consultations. Tanks, armored personnel carriers, multiple rocket launchers, and artillery rolled into the base, lined up for the final thrust toward Kabul. From his command center,
Hekmatyar worked the radio, reopening talks with Afghan communists from the faction that had earlier allied with him in a coup attempt. Dozens of Arab jihadist volunteers, allies of Hekmatyar from the days of revolution in Peshawar, poured into Charasyab, and with them came Arab journalists prepared to document the final chapter of the Islamic Revolution in Afghanistan. Hekmatyar was determined to seize the capital. In Kabul, the Afghan communist government was splitting rapidly. One faction of the old communist party prepared to surrender to Hekmatyar. Another faction planned to surrender to Massoud. In Peshawar, talks about a transitional government continued behind closed doors, led by ISI's Durrani and Prince Turki. Saudi scholars flew in hurriedly to join the talks and provide them with religious sanction. Peter Thompson and Benan Sevan tried to persuade Turki to support a broad political settlement, but they found Turki cool and remote. Prince Turki, they believed, was using his influence to stitch together an alternative compromise, one that would unite all of the Islamist leaders into a single government. To achieve this, Turki had to help prevent violence between Massoud and Hekmatyar. Even Osama bin Laden flew to Peshawar and joined the effort to forge cooperation between Hekmatyar and Massoud. He contacted Hekmatyar by radio from Peshawar and urged him to consider a compromise with Massoud. Bin Laden and other Islamist mediators arranged a half-hour radio conversation directly between Massoud and Hekmatyar. The essential question was whether the two commanders would control Kabul peacefully as allies or fight it out. Hekmatyar kept making speeches to Massoud. "I must enter Kabul and let the green flags fly over the capital," Hekmatyar said. He kept announcing to Massoud that he would not allow communists to pollute our victory, a pointed reference to Massoud's new partner, Dostum, a recent communist. Of course, Hekmatyar had his own ex-communist allies. An Arab journalist with Hekmatyar at Charasyab during the radio talk remembered Massoud as soothing, respectful. Massoud would answer him and say, "Engineer Sahib, with all respect, Kabul has fallen. Kabul cannot be conquered twice. Kabul is in your reach. It is in your hand, Engineer Sahib. Please, come to Peshawar and come back to Kabul with the rest of our leaders. I will not enter Kabul until the rest of our leaders have arrived." But Hekmatyar had secretly prepared yet another coup attempt. Even as he talked by radio with Massoud, his forces moved toward the gates of Kabul. Green flags were attached to his tanks and his jeeps. The cars were washed so they would gleam triumphantly when Hekmatyar rolled into Kabul the next day. In Peshawar, Hekmatyar's spokesman admitted, "Hekmatyar can't agree to anything that includes Ahmed Shah Massoud." Bin Laden called Hekmatyar once more on the radio. "Go back with your brothers," Bin Laden said. He asked Hekmatyar once again to consider a grand compromise, including Massoud. Hekmatyar ignored him, recalled the Arab journalist who was present. Hekmatyar had already negotiated the surrender of the Kabul headquarters of the Interior Ministry, a few blocks from the Afghan presidential palace. He dispatched his agents to Kabul that night. Hekmatyar went to bed believing that he would roll into the capital in triumph in the morning. He led prayers with the Arabs who had come to Charasyab. He recited verses from the Quran that had been recited by the Prophet after the conquering of Mecca. "So we went to sleep that night, victorious," recalled the Arab journalist. "It was great. Hekmatyar was happy. Everybody at the camp was happy. And I was dreaming that next morning, after prayer, my camera is ready, I will march with the victorious team into Kabul." Afghans are weird. They turn off the wireless when they go to sleep, as if war will stop. So they switched the wireless off, we all went to sleep, and we woke up early in the morning, prayed the dawn prayer. Spirits were high. Hekmatyar also made a very long prayer. The sun comes up again, they turn on the wireless, and the bad news starts pouring in. Convinced that Hekmatyar had no intention of compromising, Massoud had preempted him. The faction of the Afghan Communist Party that had agreed to surrender to him had seized the Kabul airport, a short march from the capital's main government buildings. Transport planes poured into Kabul carrying hundreds of Dostum's fierce Uzbek militiamen. They seized strategic buildings all across the Kabul Valley. Hekmatyar's forces quickly grabbed a few buildings, but by the end of the first day's infiltration, Massoud's positions in the city were far superior. He had formed a ring facing south toward Hekmatyar's main position. It was just like the games Massoud had played as a child on Aliabad Mountain above Kabul University. He divided his forces, encircled Hekmatyar's militia in the city, and squeezed. On the morning of Hekmatyar's imagined triumph, tank battles and street-to-street fighting erupted on Kabul's wide avenues. Fires burned on the grounds of the presidential palace. Najibullah sought shelter in a small, walled United Nations compound. He was now formally out of office and under house arrest. Hekmatyar never made it out of Charisyab. Massoud entered Kabul triumphantly from the north on a tank strewn with flowers. That night, hundreds of his mujahideen fired their assault rifles into the air in celebration, their tracer bullets lighting the sky like electric rain. By dawn, the trajectory of the tracers had shifted from vertical to horizontal, however. The first Afghan war was over. The second had begun. Massoud's Panjshiri forces and Dostum's hardened, youthful Uzbek militia pounded Hekmatyar's remnants from block to block until they fled south from Kabul after about a week. Angry and desperate, Hekmatyar began to lob rockets blindly at Kabul. It was the latest in a series of failures by Hekmatyar and Pakistani intelligence to win their coveted Afghan prize. Jalalabad, the Tanai coup attempt, the second Tanai coup attempt, and now this. Hekmatyar and ISI might have a reputation for ruthless ambition, but they had yet to prove themselves competent. In Peshawar, Yahya Massoud met with his handler in British intelligence. "We were right," the British officer told him smugly. "Hekmatyar failed, and Massoud succeeded." For all the money and time it had spent anticipating the day, the CIA played a small role in the fall of Kabul. In the two previous years, the agency had facilitated massive arms transfers to Hekmatyar and some to Massoud. The CIA's deference to Pakistani intelligence ensured that Hekmatyar received far more cash and weaponry in the last phase than he would have otherwise. But the lobbying by Peter Thompson and many others in Washington and Islamabad, including a few within the CIA, had resulted in substantial supplies being routed to Massoud as well. Just as he was preparing for Kabul's fall, Massoud had received heavy weapons in Panjshir over the road built by the U.S. Agency for International Development. His large stipends from the agency, even with their ups and downs during 1990, had provided Massoud with substantial cash at a time when Hekmatyar was reaping large donations from rich Saudi sheikhs and the Muslim Brotherhood. To that extent, the CIA, pressed by Thompson and members of Congress, had ultimately helped underwrite Massoud's final victory in Kabul. It rapidly proved pyrrhic. By 1992, there were more personal weapons in Afghanistan than in India and Pakistan combined. By some estimates, more such weapons had been shipped into Afghanistan during the previous decade than to any other country in the world. The Soviet Union had sent between $36 billion and $48 billion worth of military equipment from the time of the Afghan Communist Revolution. The equivalent U.S., Saudi, and Chinese aid combined totaled between $6 billion and $12 billion. About 500,000 people in Kabul depended on coupons for food in 1992. In the countryside, millions more lived with malnourishment, far from any reliable food source. Hekmatyar's frustration and his deep supply lines ensured that violence would continue. With the fall of Najibullah and the arrival of a rebel government in Kabul, albeit one immediately at war with itself, there was no need any longer for a U.S. ambassador to the resistance. Kabul was still much too dangerous to host an American ambassador to Afghanistan. The U.S. Embassy building in the Afghan capital remained closed. Peter Thompson was appointed to a new post managing U.S. policy in East Asia. As he prepared to move on, Thompson wrote two memos, classified confidential. He was influenced by his old contacts in the Afghan resistance who now feared the future. Abdul Haq wrote to Thompson during this period, "Afghanistan runs the risk of becoming 50 or more separate kingdoms.
Foreign extremists may want to move in, buying houses and weapons. Afghanistan may become unique in becoming both a training ground and munitions dump for foreign terrorists, and at the same time, the world's largest poppy field. Thompson, too, worried that extremist governments would control Kabul in the future, and that by withdrawing from the field, the United States was throwing away a chance to exercise a moderating influence. It was in Washington's interests to block Islamic extremists' efforts to use Afghanistan as a training-slash-staging base for terrorism in the region and beyond, he wrote on December 18, 1992. Why was America walking away from Afghanistan so quickly, with so little consideration given to the consequences? Thompson wrote a few weeks later, U.S. perseverance in maintaining our already established position in Afghanistan, at little cost, could significantly contribute to the favorable moderate outcome, which would sideline the extremists, maintain a friendship with a strategically located friendly country, help us accomplish our other objectives in Afghanistan and the broader Central Asian region, for example, narcotics, stinger recovery, anti-terrorism. We are in danger of throwing away the assets we have built up in Afghanistan over the last 10 years at great expense. Our stakes there are important, if limited, in today's geostrategic context. The danger is that we will lose interest and abandon our investment assets in Afghanistan, which straddles a region where we have precious few levers. Thompson's memos marked a last gasp from the tiny handful of American diplomats and spies who argued for continued, serious engagement by the United States in Afghanistan. There would not be an American ambassador or CIA station chief assigned directly to Afghanistan for nearly a decade, until late in the autumn of 2001. 13. A friend of your enemy. During the 1992 American presidential campaign, leaders of the Republican and Democratic parties made no mention of Afghanistan in their foreign policy platforms. As he sought re-election, President George H.W. Bush spoke occasionally and vaguely about the continuing civil war between Hekmatyar and Massoud. The heartbreak is on both sides. The tragedy is on both sides. Governor Bill Clinton of Arkansas, who focused his campaign on the weak American economy, was never quoted speaking about Afghanistan at all. Clinton devoted only 141 words to foreign affairs in his 4,200-word acceptance speech at the Democratic convention. Anthony Lake and the foreign policy team working for Clinton felt very much apart from the center, as Lake put it. The center was domestic policy. Lake had written a book about post-Cold War battlefields and had authored passages on Afghanistan, but as the campaign unfolded, it was a small blip on his radar screen, as he recalled it. Clinton sometimes spoke articulately about the global challenges America faced now that the Soviet Union was gone. He and Bush both identified terrorism and drug trafficking as emblematic threats of a new, unstable era. The biggest nuclear threat of the 1990s will come from thugs and terrorists rather than the Soviets, Clinton said early in the campaign. He wanted strong special operations forces to deal with terrorist threats. But these insights came in fleeting mentions. Clinton had never traveled to Central Asia or the Indian subcontinent. His knowledge of the region was based on impressions. He was intrigued by the recently deposed Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, who had been at Oxford University when Clinton attended as a Rhodes Scholar. Clinton had seen her in passing and was riveted by her beauty, poise, and reputation as a formidable debater, he told colleagues. His friends knew that he was also fascinated by India. He had no similar connection with Afghanistan. During his first months in office, Clinton did not think of Afghanistan as a major base for international terrorism, he told colleagues years later. He was more seriously concerned about state sponsors of terrorism, such as Iraq and Iran, and about Shiite groups such as Hezbollah and Islamic Jihad, which had killed dozens of Americans during the 1980s. Clinton knew nothing of bin Laden during the first few years of his presidency. As for Afghanistan's war, the issue languished mainly from inertia, Lake said later. It had not been a major issue in the late Bush administration, either. After his election victory, Clinton set up transition offices in Little Rock, Arkansas. Robert Gates, now the CIA director, installed a temporary CIA station, replete with security guards and secure communications, in a Comfort Inn near the Little Rock airport. Gates had decided to leave the CIA, but he agreed to stay on to help familiarize Clinton with intelligence issues and to give the new administration time to choose a new director. Gates flew in to meet the president-elect at the governor's mansion. He found Clinton exhausted, drinking copious amounts of coffee to stay awake, but engaged. Gates and Clinton were both natural analysts, sifters, and synthesizers of complex data. Gates felt that Clinton did not have the anti-intelligence, anti-CIA biases of Jimmy Carter or Michael Dukakis, the 1988 Democratic presidential nominee. Clinton consumed CIA analyses voraciously during the transition months. Gates dispatched his deputy director for intelligence to the station at the Comfort Inn. They began to provide the president's daily brief to Clinton almost immediately and commissioned a series of special intelligence studies at Clinton's request. The CIA quickly became the only department in the federal government whose senior officers were seeing the president-elect face-to-face every day. Gates became optimistic that President Clinton and the CIA would get along exceptionally well. He was wrong. The problems began with the selection of a new director. The choice was postponed until late in the transition process. Conservative Democrats on Capitol Hill urged Clinton to appoint someone with a right-leaning reputation to balance the liberals in his cabinet. The Clinton team telephoned James Woolsey, a 51-year-old Oklahoman, and told him to fly immediately to Little Rock. Woolsey was a lean, dome-headed man with soft gray eyes and a sharp, insistent voice. He had met Clinton only once, at a campaign fundraiser held at the home of Washington socialite Pamela Harriman. But Clinton and Woolsey had common roots. Like the president-elect, Woolsey had risen from the rural Southwest to win a Rhodes Scholarship and graduate from Yale Law School. As a young Army Reserve lieutenant, Woolsey had campaigned against the Vietnam War. Later, he had drifted to the political right, aligning himself with hard-line anti-communist Democrats such as Senator Henry Scoop Jackson. Woolsey spent several hours with Clinton at the governor's mansion. They talked at length about University of Arkansas and University of Oklahoma football, good places to fish in the Ozarks, and, at less length, their visions for the future of the CIA. At one point, Clinton said that he really did not think the CIA director should be a policy advisor to the president. Woolsey agreed that the director ought to just call the intelligence straight. Their meeting ended with no mention of a job offer, but the next day Warren Christopher called Woolsey at his hotel and summoned him to a press conference. "Does the president want me to be the director of the CIA?" Woolsey asked. "Sure. Just come over to the press conference and we'll get it sorted out." Woolsey asked Christopher to be certain about the job offer. Christopher stuck his head in Clinton's office, came back on the phone and said, "Yeah, that's what he wants." In a living room of the mansion, Woolsey found the Clintons, the Gores, Secretary of Defense nominee Les Aspin, Secretary of State nominee Warren Christopher, Tony Lake, Samuel L. Sandy Berger, and several political aides trying to anticipate questions they would hear from the press when Clinton introduced his new national security team. The president-elect's media specialists worried that reporters would accuse Clinton of appointing a bunch of Carter administration retreads. Woolsey could understand why, since we were, in fact, a bunch of Carter administration retreads. Trying to be helpful, Woolsey mentioned that he had served in the Bush administration, leading a team that negotiated a reduction of conventional armed forces in Europe. Clinton's press aide looked at Woolsey. "Admiral, I didn't know you served in the Bush administration." Dumbfounded, Woolsey pointed out that he had never been an admiral, only an army captain. The scene signaled the pattern of Clinton's relationship with the CIA during his first term. Distant, mutually ill-informed, and strangely nonchalant. At Langley, the change arrived abruptly. Outgoing President Bush, who had served briefly as CIA director during the Ford administration, had been the agency's most attentive White House patron in decades. He invited senior clandestine service officers to Christmas parties and to weekends at Camp David. He drew agency analysts and operators into key decision-making meetings. Within months of Clinton's inauguration, the CIA's senior officers understood that they had been shifted from being on the inside of a presidency to being almost completely on the outside. They became puzzled and then angry.